WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now, and it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth,
very
Charlie
good.
Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us, sir. How are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome. It's another Monday night. I cannot believe it is already March 1st. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk. My name is Kevin Tachi. We got a great radio program lined up for you this evening. We will start things off in a few moments, right after we check traffic, with Megan Driscoll-Greenstein. Megan, of course, you remember we've had her on a couple of times to talk a little bit about her wage transparency bill, or the bill that was put forth. Well, that bill went into was signed into law. Problem is that as Megan is going to explain to us in just a bit, is that there were a couple of things that they were noticing, especially with the folks who were hiring, that it needs to be tweaked. So we're going to talk a little bit about what this amendment is that's being put forth that is actually gaining support both in the State House and in the House of Representatives. We'll talk with Megan about that. Then we're going to speak with Adam Barisano. Adam, of course, is a local realtor who specializes in helping you buy or sell your home. We'll talk with him. Spring market right around the corner. We'll get his take on some of the things you should keep in mind if you are somebody who is looking to put your home on the market, or if you are looking to buy a home. And just keep it in mind is that there is not a lot of housing stock out there. There's not a lot out there for sale, which means that it's going to cost you a little bit more. You want to make sure you have the right person representing you when it comes time to buy a home. Hour number two, we will start it off with State Auditor Suzanne Bump. We have not had the auditor on the radio program in some time. We'll talk with her about the pilot programs when it comes to solar facilities. Study that was done by her, a study and a report that was produced by her office, as well as talking a little bit about the police reform bill and how the auditor's office played a role in that law coming into effect. And then the final guest or guests for the evening, as you may or may not recall anytime that you've listened to this program, I call the Brockton Mayor, Robert Sullivan, my co-host. He will be joining us this evening. He'll close out the show. He'll be joined by School Superintendent Mike Thomas. Exciting news coming out of the City of Champions as they have made steps towards going from all remote education to where now what they're doing is they're slowly starting to bring the students back in a hybrid model, which is great. We'll talk about that, and we'll talk about what it took to get to this point, all coming up in just a few moments. Of course, it's being brought to you. Traffic is coming up next. That is being brought to you by Brendan's Smoke Shop, online at brendansmokeshopma.com, with locations in Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham Pond, Stoughton, New Bedford, and Weymouth.
Well, thanks, Kevin. The expressway southbound, you're on the brakes from Southampton Street to Neponset Circle. Northbound's tough from Adams Street to Freeport Street. Routes 3 South and 24 South are both good, heading down to Route 44, and 93 is moving along in either direction between Braintree and Canton. This report is sponsored by Unbound.org. A girl in Kenya dreams of becoming a doctor. An elder in Guatemala dreams of being part of a community. Reach out and change their world, and it will change your own. Unbound.org. Traffic on the 9s every morning. I'm Lisa DeMilo in the WATD Traffic Center.
I'm amazed at the number of you here in the Commonwealth that aren't aware of the tobacco flavor ban. All flavored vape and tobacco products are banned from being sold here in Massachusetts, including menthol. It's okay. You can always go to New Hampshire or stop by one of our 9 locations and pick up some flavored CBD hemp wraps. Grape, pineapple, watermelon, strawberry. That's right. We have a huge selection of full-spectrum CBD hemp wraps. It's just another example of our American ingenuity. Oh, and a very special thank you to Speaker of the House Robert DeLeo for 30 years on Beacon Hill. May your greatest achievement be sending billions of Massachusetts taxpayer dollars to New Hampshire. Billions of dollars for their infrastructure, their roads, their police and firefighters, etc., etc.,
etc., etc. Count them, etc., etc.
Brennan's Smoke Shop, Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, New Bedford, and now on Bridge Street in North Weymouth. Brennan's Smoke Shop, the best smoke shop in Massachusetts. Flavored CBD hemp wraps, dudes.
Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
Traditionally, the Monday Night Talk first segment is usually something that we reserve for state representatives, state senators, usually a constitutional officer, maybe somebody from one of the neighboring communities who sits on a board, or you know, it's a mayor, but we're making a special, how can I say this? We're doing something differently because of the nature of the conversation. Joining us right now is Megan Driscoll Greenstein. Did I say that right or did I say it wrong?
You said it right.
Okay. She's joining us to talk a little bit about a piece of legislation that I know that she's been championing for some time now. This legislation is geared towards wage transparency. If you aren't aware, depending on your gender, these days men are paid more, and there's a significant imbalance. And I believe that this legislation will hopefully shine some light on that, and there'll be a more of a discussion. But Megan is here to kind of basically give us the nuts and the bolts of it and where it stands at this particular time.
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me, Kevin, as usual. So actually, the reason this is all based on a law that was passed in 2016 and then it was enacted in 2018. The first ever Pay Equity Act was passed in Massachusetts. When you do something like that, when you do something out of the box, right, and forward thinking and progressive, now 2018, we should have passed it earlier. A lot of people would argue that. But you're unable to see kind of like how the decisions that you make play out in real time. And so there were some significant issues that came up from that law. The law essentially said that you could no longer ask an prospective employee, so someone who was applying for a job, what they were currently earning. And I mean, the idea of that is great, right? Because if you are always basing it off what someone is always earning, and women and minorities are always earning less, then women and minorities will never earn more, will never get to pay parity. So fundamentally, it made a lot of sense. But what happened when we played that out, when that actually got enacted, is that companies, they could no longer ask what you're currently earning. They replaced that question with, what are your expectations? And two things happened. Number one, I don't think it's surprising, but men are better at coming up with higher expectations. So they were still asking for more money. And then number two, without having the hinge of what somebody was earning, that truth, that piece of information that you can use to base an offer off of, companies were really left like in the dark with how to go forward with candidates and making them offers. And companies became very frustrated with the process. They would interview candidates, get all the way to the end, make an offer, only to find out that the offer was actually less than what the candidate was currently earning. So a lot of frustration. So not only did it not necessarily help women in the way that it thought it would help, but it also kind of hurt companies in the process of trying to onboard candidates and overpaying, essentially. So that's where the idea for the bill originally came, was to kind of solve some of the problems that the original pay equity bill created and kind of clean that up and then go a little bit further to actually help women and minorities. And so this bill is an amendment to that Equal Pay Act. And what it would do is it would require that companies share the pay range for a job when an applicant is applying for the role. So right off the get-go, a candidate can ask what that range is, and then that can help them set their expectations. And right off the get-go, candidates who are earning outside of that range can choose to opt out of the system early and not waste a client's time. In addition, we go a little bit further, and what we also do is we are requiring that companies share a pay range for candidates who are in the seats. So employees would be able to go to their hiring or their managers and ask what the pay range is for the job that they're currently in. The 2018 Pay Act only applied to candidates applying for new jobs. So it was aiming to help women and minorities. And it did it through the application process. But the issue is really only like 5% of people change jobs year over year. So you weren't really helping that many women and minorities because the help was really in such a small, specific niche area. So this would allow women and minorities and anybody really interested to ask their hiring managers what their pay range is. And if they're at the bottom of that pay range, they would be able to advocate for themselves. What skills am I missing? You know, what responsibilities do I need to take on? How do I better myself within that range? So we think it would help, like I said, it cleans up some business issues that were created with the existing law and goes a little bit further to helping women and minorities equal or achieve pay parity.
So who right now is championing this amendment? Is this something that you feel that could be fast-tracked? Or is this something that's going to have to go through the normal rigors that any bill does?
Well, we last year, prior to COVID, we were a late file, so we got going a little bit late. And we actually kind of sailed through labor and workforce development. We were in third reading, and then COVID hit and the kind of whole world changed, obviously. This year, we're getting a totally different response. So we not only are filing it in both the House, but the Senate as well. So our Senate sponsor is Senator Pat Jalin. Our House sponsor is Rep. Josh Cutler, who was originally the person I went to and created this this bill. Last year. And in the last week, since we've been asking for co-sponsors, we have over 35 co-sponsors of the bill, both Senate and on the legislative side, both in the Senate and in the House. And we're getting a lot of momentum and a lot of excitement about it. So I'm thrilled because I think that when you talk to people, both Republican and it's a bipartisan bill, both Republican and Democrat alike believe that this has value. And one of the things I think is so important for right now, too, is we've lost 2.5 million women in the workforce because of COVID. So we have women and minorities who are going to be getting back into this workforce, and we need to make sure that we're protecting them. Likewise, we're going to be doing, I hope, fingers crossed, things go well. We're going to have a resurgence of hiring in the late spring next year. And companies need to be prepared so that they're not ending up overpaying and going through this whole rigmarole of hiring candidates for jobs that they're ultimately not going to take because they're not in the right pay range. So I'm hoping that there's some urgency, too, with what COVID has done to our workforce.
And again, if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Megan Driscoll-Greenstein, and we're talking with her about her wage transparency. It's an amendment, from what I understand, to a law that was put on the books in 2016, and it is getting some significant acknowledgement from not only from the state Senate, but also from the House of Reps. Any thoughts? Have you had anybody look at it and give any kind of constructive criticism that maybe there might be something that needs to be added to this? Again, you this is something that you learned when the first bill was passed.
This is
an adjustment to that.
Yeah. So ultimately, you know, again, I'm hoping that's not hindsight is 2020 and we realize, oh gosh, you know, I think this is a step further. This is not going to solve wage transparency. This bill is not going to solve pay parity in Massachusetts. We are not anytime soon going to have women and minorities paid equally for the same jobs that white men have. That's not going to happen. We're years and years and years away from that. But this will get us one step further. And furthermore, even more importantly, right, it will prevent companies in Massachusetts massively overpaying for candidates and wasting tons of time and energy on interviewing candidates they could never have had in the first place. One of the first meetings we had when we started talking about this bill was with the Attorney General to find out what were they hearing about the bill, when the original bill, when it was enacted. And they were hearing the exact same thing that I was seeing on the business side. Companies calling the Attorney General and saying, this is impossible for us. We're wasting all this time. We're trying to hire these people. We can't, we're making offers that they're not taking, and so frustrating. And so the Attorney General would say to them, we'll publish the pay range then. And their response was, well, right now, nobody else publishes the pay range, so that's a competitive disadvantage if we were to do so. So this really aims to kind of eliminate that competitive disadvantage. If everybody is sharing the range for their jobs, there shouldn't be any issue with doing so. And so, you know, I think that, you know, really, this has been built out of concerns that people have already expressed about the equal pay bill, right? So this is not purely some social bill for women and minorities. This was born out of a business problem that needed to be solved. And so I think because of that, it's gained a lot of support.
And are you asking anybody, have you been active in asking folks to get their state reps and state senators to sign on this so that at least once this gets to a certain point where it's heard, you know, that this could be something that moves along without it dying in study somewhere?
Yeah, so not quite yet. We haven't gone to like the, you know, the public and say, have your senator or your rep sign on board. We've been basically just speaking directly with senators and representatives, many of whom were aware of the bill last year, but it just didn't get a chance to actually make its way through. But we are reaching out. One of the things that I'm really interested in is I've always been a Chamber of Commerce member. I was the 2018 Greater Boston CEO of the Year in 2018. And so the Chamber has been a place that I have always gone for support with my business over the years that I ran my business. And so what I am doing right now is reaching out to chambers. I already have 4 or 5 chambers that are supporting the bill, and I'm really trying to gain support there. So I am looking for members of chambers who would be interested in championing this as well, because I do think that this is, you know, like I said, it's a business-based bill.
It's worth asking. It seems as though you have a knack for not only discussing and helping with the creation and authoring bills like this. Any appetite to any other pieces of legislation that maybe is in the works that you feel that may help when it comes to equality, whether it's women, minorities, anything like that?
Yeah, so there's a couple other bills that are being considered too. There's one through the mayor's office. There's another one for women on boards. You know, there are basically two reasons why women and minorities earn less, overall, right? So why is that gap? Why is it 72 cents on the dollar, right? Why does it turn out to be that way? There's two reasons. Number one, women and minorities are paid at the bottom of the ranges. So it's not like they're not paid out of the range. They're not paid outside the scope of the job. But if the project manager position pays between 70 and 90, women and minorities are below 75 and men are over 85, right? And so that causes a disparity broadly across the workforce. But then in addition, you have less female and minorities in senior executive level jobs. And so I think the women on boards and the women and minorities on boards bill, I can't remember the number right now, but I'm actually really excited about that too, because I think that can make a really big difference. And there's so much research on why having a diverse board it makes for better business. You know, companies that have more diversity in their upper ranks make more money, have higher client satisfaction rates, have higher employee satisfaction rates, right? So there's a lot of like really good data out there. Like McKinsey puts out some great information. Harvard has always put out some great information, the business school, with which is just proven fact for why diversity on boards and in senior leadership makes a big difference in an overall company success. So I'm also looking at that. Ultimately, what I'd like to do is get this passed in Massachusetts and then bring the show on the road, right? Every state in the country has some version of a pay equity bill either passed or on the books to be passed. And I would like to help the ones that haven't passed a bill avoid the pitfalls of what happened in Massachusetts. The ones that have passed the bill, help them take it a little bit further.
And just so folks know, again, we've been speaking with Megan Driscoll Greenstein, who I believe is the founder and owner. I'm doing a little scrolling here. Don't tell anybody. For Megan Driscoll Consulting.
So previously I founded and started Pharmalogix Recruiting, which is actually one of the largest recruiting companies in New England. I stepped down as a CEO last year, so I'm currently doing consulting individually now.
So just to share with folks, what we were talking about is the amendment for an act relative to wage transparency, which has been filed by the Senate and the House, and those numbers are HD 253 and SD 414. Just keep that in the back of your head. And when the call goes out, you can't say that you were not warned ahead of time that we need your support for this piece of legislation. Megan, anything that we haven't touched upon, but you have a couple of moments here before you go that you want to share with the folks or at least remind folks about?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, just my regular run-of-the-mill, like, plug, right, is that I don't believe that men ever want to earn more money than women. I don't think that if you asked, surveyed people that they would want that to happen. Yet I do think that we have to have just a general understanding that it is happening, right? It's happening in every company. The only place it really isn't happening is when you work at a company that publishes pay salaries, like the government, right? And so in every other organization, you can bet that the woman sitting next to you in the job that you're in is being paid less. And, you know, I don't think anybody wants that. So we it's not fair and nobody wants it. But we have to do something about that, right? We have to, like, actively make change in order to fix this problem that is sort of endemic in our society. And quite honestly, actually started with a federal pay act that went into effect in 1945, I think. And it was to basically, when they were trying to fill jobs that men had left to go fight the war, they wrote in the act that they could hire women. Women could work, but they were to be paid 25% less than the male who had left that job. And it's funny that nothing really has changed since then. And so I think that now's the time, right? Now's the time to do something about it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. And I look for you to come back. And you're overdue to come in. I mean, I want to say a year and a half ago, we had talked about having you on regularly to be a co-host and do different conversations. And we should, once COVID, it kind of... goes by the wayside, we should probably try to have that conversation.
I'm available.
Okay.
Always for you, Kevin.
Appreciate it, definitely, and appreciate all the work that you do. Megan Driscoll Greenstein has been our guest. We're going to step aside, and when we come back in a few moments, I swear, I promise you, more Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
If you want a drink, that's your business. If you want to stop, that's for Alcoholics Anonymous.
AA is an inclusive fellowship of individuals all around the world. The one thing you need to ask yourself is, am I ready to do something about my drinking problem? For more information, literature, and videos about Alcoholics Anonymous, and to find a meeting near you, call 617-426-9444 or visit AA.org.
Invest your time in listening to Cape Retirement Radio and learn a smarter approach to investing so you can protect your future. Cape Retirement Radio, featuring Chris Letond, Thursday nights at 6:15 and Sunday mornings at 10 on 95.9 WATD. The IRS doesn't mess around. If they want your money, they'll take it. They can take your paycheck and bank accounts too, even threaten your home or business. Don't take on the IRS alone. If you owe back taxes, the smartest thing you can do is call Optima Tax Relief. The experts at Optima specialize in a powerful IRS tax assistance program called the Fresh Start Initiative. And their clients that qualify are saving thousands, even tens of thousands. One call starts the process to stop the demand letters, stop aggressive collection actions, and stop the IRS from targeting you. But don't delay. It's important to act now while you still have options. Optima is A-plus rated with the Better Business Bureau. Optima has already resolved over $1 billion of tax debt for their clients. Get your life back. For tax help you need, for tax help you can trust, call Optima now for your free consultation.
Call 800-343-6460. 800-343-6460. 800-343-6460.
Optima Tax Relief.
Some restrictions apply. For complete details, please visit OptimaTaxRelief.com.
The People's Truth, a show dedicated to bringing communities together and keeping the truth alive. Join your host, me, Benny Rabbi, as we talk with businesses, organizations, and people around New England and the world in search of the People's Truth. Join us tonight at 9 p.m. on 95.9 WATD.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Don't just listen, say something. Call 781-837-4900. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk, 95.9 WATD. And this is a timely segment that we're going to be diving into in just a few moments here. Spring right around the corner. If you're somebody who is maybe you're thinking about putting your house on the market. Maybe you want, you know, you want to go from that smaller home. Maybe you need a little bit of extra room. Maybe you're somebody who wants to buy a home. You're a first-time home buyer. Well, you know, right now is the time to look for that person who's going to be the bulldog for you and help you when it comes to finding a home or selling a home, listing your home. Joining us right now is Adam Barisano. He's a realtor for Jack Conway, and we're here to talk a little bit about the real estate and the spring market. Adam, welcome to Monday Night Talk, sir.
I'll tell you something, cuz. You forgot to mention the cousin thing.
Yeah, but you know what? You can always separate friends and business, and
we don't want any. We don't want them saying Barisano got in here because of the whole nepotism thing. You know,
correct.
That's the last thing I need.
The last thing you need. But, you know, I usually choose carefully who's going to come on. And yes. And I've watched you. You're somebody who's out there who, when it comes to helping somebody, whether it's sell their home or buy a home, you're second to many people I know when they are out there. They got a real estate license. They take it seriously. You're one of those guys who works extra hard for your clients.
You know, I'll tell you this, Kevin. This is my full-time gig. It's my passion. It drives me every single day. And I like to say to every client that I have, whether it be the seller or the buyer, I am going to lead you through the process from point A to Z. Because a lot of times buyers and sellers, they jump into this and they say, I feel so stupid. I don't know what I'm doing, Adam. And my whole thing is, you're not at all supposed to know what you're doing the same way I don't know how to do your job. I'm going to lead you through this. I like to think of myself almost as a coach. I like to coach them through because I have been a football coach. I've done a lot of things with coaching, and that's how I view my clients.
How is this year different than any other, seeing that we're living through a pandemic, but we're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel right now?
We are. We're finally seeing. So this, you know, what are we? We're on March 1st tonight, huh?
Yeah.
I don't know where the year's going. It's already starting to fly. But I think what's so different about this is after the pandemic started, I went about a month, a little over a month. And we just went at a, like, time froze, Kevin. You know, time completely froze. And these clients and these buyers and these people that I had listing, everybody just kind of completely stopped. And we sat and what are we going to do? Next thing I knew, I was back on the road with buyers again. And this time we were wearing masks. We had gloves on. I mean, I had my father's full painter mask on at some point because I didn't know what mask to buy, Kevin. I didn't know what I mean, we have adapted now quite well to this new world of real estate in a pandemic, and it's been the most crazy seller's market that we've ever seen in history. I think it's safe to say in history, at least in my time, you know, in this world, I've never seen anything like it. And we're operating under whole new guidelines now. But yes, you're all right, Kevin, with there is a light at the end of the tunnel. And I think that light could be a good one.
Some of the things that folks should consider if they are going to dive into the spring market, maybe they're looking to buy their first home. Maybe they're looking to buy another home. What are some of the advice and tips that you can give them in regards to buying a home this spring?
Patience. Understand right now we have a lack of inventory. But if you're working with somebody like me, I am going to, once we finally find, Kevin, this is what I call it. I call it the home spark. Once we feel the home spark and we know what you want and we know what you're looking for and we feel that energy, at that point in time, give me the patience. We're going to construct the best offer. Now, I'm not going to really go over how I do my offers. I'm not going to show the playbook right now.
No.
All right, Kevin, because you might steal it from me. It's a touchy thing.
Yeah.
We borrow from each other. No, but anyway, honest to God, you know, jokes aside, this is crazy right now. So with the inventory shortage, you're going to need so much patience, so much patience. But rest assured, the light at the end of the tunnel, as we said before, I will get you to that light at the end of the tunnel, and I will win that offer for you.
Knowing that anytime if you're talking about inventory, you're talking about it's supply and demand. When you talk about patience, should a buyer also be patient and not jump at the first thing that they see in the first offer because it could tend to be a little bit higher?
When you talk about, you know, jumping at the first offer, we're looking at some of these prices right now. People are going in 30 grand to 40 grand over asking. And, it's important for these mortgage buyers to remember, you know, this is what scares us. This is what scares people. Will the property appraise? Now, if you're with a good enough agent, remember when you're writing an offer, and this is the only tip I'll really give, when you're writing that very special offer, wording and language is everything to keep your buyers protected. And when you're on the other side, wording and language and contracts is everything to keep your sellers protected. If that sort of answers the question, yeah, but prices they're skyrocketing right now. And you bring up supply and demand, Kevin. The supply and demand is it, you know, the supply is low and the demand is just through the roof. And then these interest rates, I mean, they're so low and all these buyers, there's an influx of first time home buyers and they're just going for it.
It's interesting that you mentioned that because that was the next thing I was going to bring up is that it seems that we've seen the interest rates stay relatively low. I mean, it's not like back in the 90s when we saw it balloon to double digits.
Right.
It's low. I mean, it's somewhere around, I would say, the mid threes or has it changed?
Yeah, I saw 2.75 the other day on a conventional. And we were expecting, you know, obviously when a president leaves office and a new president comes in, they were expecting the rates to potentially really jump really high. And fortunately for everybody, we didn't get to that point. We kind of got there. I mean, we saw a little bit of a jump, but rates sort of fluctuated as of right now. Now, I can't predict what they'll do. And, you know, I don't think any of us can, but we're lucky and we're blessed right now, so to say, because they're staying where they need to be.
How important is it that someone wants to buy a home that they can at least put together a list of what they have to have when it comes to buying a home, a property with the lot size? How does that make your job easier to be able to help them in the long run?
When they come prepared or?
Yeah, when they come prepared, they know what they want. They know what they want for in a home. They know what areas they want on the South Shore. Does that make your job easier? If you're dealing with somebody who is indecisive and changing what they want, that makes your job a little harder than if somebody goes, this is what I want, this is what I need.
You know what it is, Kevin? I'm so easy to adapt that, honest to God, when I tell you right now, whether they come prepared and they know exactly what they want or whether they come and they haven't even got a pre-approval, I'm going to feel them out. I'm going to almost have them have a job interview, right? Where they interview me and they find out what I can do for them. I mean, prepared or not, it doesn't make my job easier or not. I feel that, you know, being prepared, it's not a factor for me. You know, find any client, send them my way, and the most prepared person or the least prepared person, I'm going to find them a home.
And we're speaking with Adam Barisano with the Jack Conway Realtors. And we're talking a little bit about the spring market, and they're talking about him as someone who will get the job done as a realtor, someone who's there. He's willing to take the job interview to help you succeed as somebody who's looking to buy a home. Let's flip the coin here, talking about somebody who wants to sell their home and they're seeking the right agent who's going to help them sell it and be able to do it in a timely manner. What are some of the important things if you're going into this market as a seller?
Well, talk about being king of the hill, so to say. Sellers rule the roost right now. And if you're potential sellers out there and you're thinking about it, pat yourself on the back right now, because you are in charge of the real estate market right now. What's going to be so important on my end for sellers is you are going to be receiving so many offers, so many that you don't know what to do with. And this is where kind of I like to not so much attack people who want to sell their house on their own, but educate them. Somebody like me, I'm going to be able to read and interpret what's going to be the best offer. Conditions of the offer mean everything. But if you're the seller right now, we're going to get you top of the line offers. No question about it. No question about it. And what's going to also help so much, and I have to plug Jack Conway with this, is we have the best marketing department. Jack Conway and Company has the best marketing in the entire business of real estate. It was a major factor of why I made the jump to Jack Conway and Company. We are going to market your property with video, professional photography. We have this system now called Matterport that a lot of top agents are using, where you can actually take a virtual video tour, photo tour throughout the house, Kevin. It's unbelievable. So marketing your property is everything. But in the market that we're at right now, the truth is you could put cell phone pictures up of some of these listings and still get the big thing here is going to be negotiating these offers and helping these sellers see what's good, what's not. And one thing I pride myself in, Kevin, is because I came from the mortgage business, I know what pre-approvals look good, what mortgage companies look good, and I know which ones aren't as favorable to the sellers.
So how important is it as a seller that you're realistic when it comes to what you're hoping to get for a return when you sell your home? How important is that?
That's super important. You have to always gauge the seller's. You know, a lot of people, obviously, when I sell my home, when you sell your home, Kevin, you always think to yourself, oh, I know we can get this because it's your own home. What's so important is you're choosing somebody, a realtor, an agent, to sort of, you know, lead you down the path of righteousness, so to say, and do a proper market analysis on your home, you know, proper comparables. And again, in this market right now, it's unprecedented, the offers that are coming in. But on a normal day, say, let's rewind back to 2019, 2018. You know, super important to come to the table with comparable properties to show the sellers sort of this is where you're going to be worth. And of course, you know, then you factor in things like what people have done to their house, what people have done to make their homes better. And, you know, that can also increase value or lower value, you know?
Are you the type of agent that does things like doing, you know, sales prep, maybe doing staging for showing, stuff like that?
Oh, you just set me up, because you just set me up perfectly for that answer right there, and I love it. We here at Jack Conway and Company have the best staging company, again, in the game. There's just nothing that Jack Conway doesn't offer for sellers, and I'm quick to, if I walk into a home and I say, look, no offense, I think some staging could do some benefit. That's a service that I provide for free to my sellers. You know, I think it's huge for sellers to understand that. Find yourself an agent that's going to give back, because we do do well in the business of real estate, but we put in a lot of work as well. And I think it's important to go the extra mile with my marketing. So home staging is huge and it can greatly, greatly increase the price of your sale.
Now, you and I are talking shop, and there might be a novice, a first-time home seller out there who doesn't understand what exactly is home staging.
Home staging. So you have furniture loaded up in one room, right? And the room really isn't showing its full potential. What happens is I come in with my home stager, and they say, all right, you know what? This is what's going to look best in pictures. This is what's going to look best in video. This is what's going to look best in a virtual tour, whether it be video or a photo virtual tour, like I was telling you before. And they have a vision. Now, I feel I have a decent staging vision, but these home stagers at Jack Conway, they're on another level. I mean, they are on another level. They come in and they just know what they're doing. And you see the pictures. And so what, like, you know, a room that's crowded with stuff, Kevin, they literally can just find these ways of even like adding a simple plant. And they always have the stuff. Conway, they have the furniture, they have the plants, they have the fixtures to add to the room. And next thing you know, this room looks like something magnificent, you know? And it is just, I can't express how important staging is.
And we're speaking with Adam Barisano. He's been our guest for this segment. Adam, you're not going to believe this, but we only got a couple of minutes left in this.
Are you serious?
I'm not kidding you. We've really kind of locked it up here. If there's any nugget or any stone we haven't turned over, anything that you want to really impress upon our listeners in regards to the spring market, regardless if they're selling, regardless if they're buying, what do you want to, this is your chance for a home run swing here. Yeah. What do you want to say to the folks who are tuned in right now?
I just want to say to my sellers right now, I want you to understand that if you hire Adam Barisano to sell, you are going to get top of the line marketing. If you need to call me and you're stressing out and you need to speak at midnight, I'm that guy. I do accompanied showings only. I don't believe in the lockbox situation. I feel your home is your private place. It's so much more. Your home is your life, right? So I am going to give you a personal touch that I feel is, and there's so many great agents out there. There's so many to choose from. And, you know, with me, I have my own personal touch to it. And, you know, I feel my work speaks for itself. Now with buyers, aggression, like we were talking before, I am a bulldog when it comes to, or a pit bull when it comes to my buyers. They are, especially first-time home buyers, but all buyers in general, you need to be aggressive right now more than ever. So with somebody like me, you're never not going to have your questions answered. The phone rang three times during this interview, Kevin. First-time home buyers and buyers in general who I'm working with right now who just have questions. It's about always being available. It's about always being accountable. It's about always sort of, like you said, hitting the home run for my buyers and my sellers. And that's what I intend to do on both ends of it. And I am a little over the top and eccentric. It's because I love this so much, you know?
And if folks want to find out more, folks want to reach out to you, and they're interested in getting a little bit of the Barisano experience, feel free to give that information.
Absolutely. So please, everybody, take out your pens, take out your paper, take out your whatever phone you have, whatever device you like, all right, and take them down my number, 781-561-5044. Follow me on Adam Barisano Realtor on Instagram and Adam Barisano Realtor on Facebook. And if you don't get to me first, I'll get to you. I'm telling you.
Adam Barisano, he'll give you more than the professional touch. It'll be more like your family. Adam, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Kevin. It was a true pleasure. Thank you so much.
You got it. We're going to step aside. Top of the hour, hour number two coming up. We got State Auditor Suzanne Bump, who's going to be joining us in just a few moments. You're tuned in to Monday Night Talk, heard only on 95.9 WATD.
FM Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. The South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. WATD. Streaming online at 95.9WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD.
What is AA? Alcoholics Anonymous is an international fellowship of men and women who've had a drinking problem.
It is non-professional and self-supporting.
AA is multiracial, apolitical, and available almost everywhere.
There are no age or education requirements. Membership is open to anyone who wants to do something about their drinking problem.
Call 617-426-9444 or find online meetings at aa-intergroup.org.
The IRS doesn't mess around. If they want your money, they'll take it. They can take your paycheck and bank accounts too, even threaten your home or business. Don't take on the IRS alone. If you owe back taxes, the smartest thing you can do is call Optima Tax Relief. The experts at Optima specialize in a powerful IRS tax assistance program called the Fresh Start Initiative. And their clients that qualify are saving thousands, even tens of thousands. One call starts the process to stop the demand letters, stop aggressive collection actions, and stop the IRS from targeting you. But don't delay. It's important to act now while you still have options. Optima is A-plus rated with the Better Business Bureau. Optima has already resolved over $1 billion of tax debt for their clients. Get your life back. For tax help you need, for tax help you can trust, call Optima now for your free consultation.
Call 800-343-6460. 800-343-6460. 800-343-6460.
Optima Tax Relief.
Some restrictions apply. For complete details, please visit OptimaTaxRelief.com.
The People's Truth, a show dedicated to bringing communities together and keeping the truth alive. Join your host, me, Benny Rabbi, as we talk with businesses, organizations, and people around New England and the world in search of the People's Truth. Join us tonight at 9 p.m. on 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD. Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk.
Joining us for this segment is State Auditor Susan Bump. Auditor, welcome.
I am delighted to be back, Kevin. Thank you. It's been a while.
It has been a while, and I've been looking forward to having a conversation. Unfortunately, we got this little pandemic that's kind of shuffled our lives around and kind of made things a little bit difficult and different. So
that's for sure.
We have a couple of great topics to talk about. I think, but before we get started, it's worth making sure the folks understand fully what it is that the State Auditor's Office does, especially when it comes to state government and for the protection of the residents.
Well, thanks, Kevin. I really do appreciate the opportunity to talk about the work that the office does. As the name suggests, we do auditing, but a lot of people think that means that we do financial auditing for the state, but really we do what's called performance auditing. So yes, we care about how money has been spent, how much has been spent. What we also want to look at, though, in our performance auditing is whether proper safeguards have been enacted to ensure that it's not subject to waste, fraud, abuse, that unholy trinity of things that can go wrong with state finances. And we also want to see that agencies are using the money effectively to fulfill their missions to the public. So that makes up the bulk of what we do. We audit every department of state government on a three-year cycle. I really have a lot of discretion here in my office to decide what exactly we're going to look at. Whenever we look at a department, we actually get a lot of feedback, though, and input from members of the public and from members of the legislature as well. A couple of other things that the office does, though, is conduct public assistance benefits fraud. We work with agencies like
the Department of Transitional Assistance and MassHealth to investigate folks who we suspect are getting benefits that they are not entitled to. They may have been hiding income. They may have been claiming that they had a dependent child in their home when the child was not present in the home and the like. So that's another big piece of the work. And then another part of the work that we do that I know you really want to talk about today comes under the Division of Local Mandates. So we hear, particularly if you're involved in local government, the idea of unfunded mandates. The state imposes requirements on municipalities to do this, that, or the other thing, but this, that, or the other thing has a cost. And the question is, who should be paying for it? And there's a legal analysis that we have to apply when we're asked by a municipality or a legislator, for that matter, as to who's responsible, the local taxpayers or state government, for funding particular programs and do the financial analysis. We've been very busy with local elections officials, for instance, the pandemic. You mentioned the pandemic and all of the changes in methods of voting. Some of that, those costs are borne by municipalities themselves, but others are borne by the state, and we have a role in helping sort that out.
I think before we move into our first topic, I should congratulate you and congratulate your office. My understanding is that someone in your office has been bestowed the William R. Snodgrass Distinguished Leadership Award. I think it's one of your first deputy auditors. Is that correct?
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. Meredith Barrio was one of the first hires that I made when I took the office. She came from the private sector. I brought her in because we needed to upgrade our policies and procedures so that our work was meeting the standards that are set for government auditing by the federal government. And Meredith has been with me for 11 years. Almost 11 years. She's worked her way up to be the first deputy auditor, and she has been really responsible for initiating a whole quality control unit, if you will, within the office, enhancing our training. When I came on board, I asked for a peer review to be done by the State Auditors Association, and the office did not get good marks on that. We've had two subsequent peer reviews to make sure, kind of certificate of excellence. And under her leadership, we have twice succeeded in getting the highest level you could. So it's a real feather in her cap. I get a lot of credit for turning the office around, but Meredith has been right there beside me, and she was just recognized by a national organization, the Association of Government Accountants. So it's very exciting.
And congratulations. And I didn't want to say her last name and not say her Barrio. I wasn't sure.
No, Barrio, that's it. Meredith Barrio.
Well, congratulations to her and congratulations to your office. I know how hard you and your staff work, and it's great to receive recognition that, in fact, that your office is trending in the right direction for the people.
Yeah, thank you.
One of your recent reports, and you kind of teased it a little bit in regards to local government, generated was in regards to the state's pilot program for solar facilities. Pilot, of course, is an acronym for paid in lieu of taxes. Now, I guess there's a decision that was made by an appellate tax board. There was some confusion that it caused amongst local, town, and city governments. How did this issue with the program come to be audited or recognized by your office?
Well, so this was a matter for our Division of Local Mandates. We actually looked at two different kinds of payment in lieu of taxes programs within the state. One is the payments that the state makes directly to municipalities in lieu of taxes for certain facilities that are housed there. corrections facilities maybe, or the fire training academy. Not every agency that has, that owns land in a municipality and serves a state government purpose carries with it a payment in lieu of taxes payment, but we looked at that. But then we also looked at this whole payment in lieu of taxes situation for the big commercial solar arrays that so many communities are having installed as to create an alternative form of energy. So years ago, you might remember, and really decades ago, when solar installations were being encouraged on residential properties, it was decided that the value of the residential solar equipment would not be added to a home's value and therefore increase the property tax payment. So those improvements, you know, if you add a wing to your house, that improvement is going to result in a greater assessment and you're going to pay a greater tax, property tax bill. Well, they didn't want that rule to apply to solar because they wanted to encourage people to do it. So they made those solar installations tax exempt. And then when commercial solar arrays came along, those were to be understood to be paying property taxes because they were occupying acres of land, and communities weren't going to give that source of revenue up. But they worked out payments in lieu of taxes so that there was more predictability both on the part of the town who would be getting money from the solar developers and also on the part of solar developers who wouldn't be subject to fluctuations in taxation. So they would work out payment plans over a multi-year period. And that was fine until some solar developers started challenging municipalities. They didn't want to make these payments in lieu of taxes. And they went to the appellate tax board, and the appellate tax board looked at the only law that there was on the books, and they said, this law that has traditionally been applied to residential solar installations doesn't say only residential solar installations, so we're going to interpret it as meaning commercial ones as well. And there have been a series of appellate tax board decisions that have really put municipalities in quite a tizzy, because no longer were solar developers willing to negotiate payments in lieu of taxes. And it really had, in recent years, the effect of suppressing the expansion of these facilities. I mean, granted, there are other reasons why some communities have established moratoriums. You know, some of it just has to do with the vast amounts of clear cutting that goes on to accommodate some of these arrays, cutting down of trees. But it also had to do with the loss of public revenue. And you know, you're close to local government, so you can appreciate the problem that posed. So we took a look at this situation because, again, it was state decision making that was having an impact on local revenues. And we just said, you know, this is unsustainable as a policy. Thankfully, you're bringing it to the attention of the wider world helped spur the activity in the last legislative session on this issue. There had been some legislation to try to distinguish between large generators of solar power and small ones, and we helped to bring together municipal assessors and other local officials as well as solar developers to reach some agreement on this, and it was contained in the climate change bill that the legislature had put before the governor.
And I was going to ask you about that, because I understood that the pending climate change bill was supposed to help clear that up. Did the auditor's office or your report have any impact on any language or amendments that were added to the bill?
We didn't recommend specific formulas that they would use to determine how much power that would be generated would be a cutoff that would distinguish a residential from a commercial. But what we did was just spur the conversation forward and bring the parties to a resolution, because we just helped create that opportunity for the conversation to take place. And so there was some back and forth between the legislature and the governor on other elements of the climate change bill, but this was not an element of contention between the governor and the legislature. So that will stand.
Probably so, one of my last questions on this would be is knowing that solar is such a challenging industry, it seems as though it's going to be difficult to continuously gauge the taxation for that said equipment. So it sounds like it might be something we're going to be keeping an eye on.
Yeah, so now payments in lieu of taxes are back. You know, it's they may not be subject to property taxes, but the payments in lieu of taxes will provide that stream of revenue to the communities that would be lost otherwise. And it gets us to a greener future.
Definitely, indeed. Again, if you're just tuning in, we are speaking with the state auditor, Suzanne Bump. She is my guest for this segment. Our next discussion is in regards to the new police reform law. It was a bill. At the end of 2020, the Governor Baker, actually signed into law that new piece of legislation. I believe the auditor's office assembled a study that called for expanded resources and accountability when it comes to police training in Massachusetts. What were the main deficiencies that the report was able to highlight?
Well, back at the end of 2019, we looked again at the cost burden borne by municipalities of police training. The state said every police officer has to have 40 hours of training, but you're gonna have to, essentially, they said, you're going to have to figure out how you're going to pay for it yourself. And so communities were putting upwards of $23 million into police training, and the state was providing very little support for that through its Municipal Police Training Commission. We told the state that they had to be doing better. It's too much of a burden for municipalities. We need police that are skilled, not just in gun handling, but in dealing with mental health crises and domestic violence and sexual assault and the range of social issues that unfortunately our police have to respond to. It's not just traffic accident reconstruction. There are a lot of skills that our police officers have to have, and the state has been doing a disservice to them. We also said, though, you know, while you're at it, while you're focused on training, why don't we have a mechanism to ensure that all police are getting trained? Because we found in our work that was not the case, because many towns couldn't afford it. And we said, so let's have a system that exists in 46 other states, which is peace officer standards and training. It is essentially a certification program for police that ensures not just that they're getting the training that they need, but that also there is accountability for any disciplinary procedures that they go through, stemming from things like excessive use of force. And when we put that out, at the end of 2019, there was some interest in it, but it wasn't until we had the death of George Floyd when people really started to pay attention to how adequately police were trained and how adequately police were policed. And so our recommendations helped inform that part of the bill that was put get through the legislature and onto the governor's desk. You know, we weren't involved with deciding questions or making recommendations about use of force by police and no-knock warrants and the like, but the whole notion of accountability and support for our police officers, we helped to advance. Our work was cited numerous times by all the parties. The chiefs of police had been advocating for this for years, And we gave a lot of credibility to the needs of the police chiefs.
Yeah, some of the information that was put out there actually stated that 84% of the police chiefs in the Commonwealth were in favor of this.
And yes.
In favor of such legislation like this.
Right, because they knew that they weren't doing all they could to support their own officers because they lacked the resources to do so. So we have a law that's enacted, but of course, now it's about the funding. And so I actually just within the past couple of days met with virtually, of course, with the Secretary of Public Safety about how well implementation is going. And the police departments are being very, cooperative and getting all of the information fed into a central database and setting up systems and standards. We still have a way to go. And a lot more money, though, needs to be put into the training on the part of the state.
A major piece of legislation like this that has been turned into a law, is there a chance that your office could revisit and take a look at this law in a few years just to kind of see how it's trending and how it's doing?
Yeah, no doubt we will. We will do that. Yeah. And so while the work was initiated by our local mandates division, it will be the audit operations that will go in to see that the funding is there, that they are indeed created standards, that they're implementing those standards. It's going to take a lot of coordination with local police departments. Let me tell you, this is not going to be simple. There are a lot of standards and rules and processes. Because it's one thing to accuse an officer of inappropriate behavior. He has a right, though, to defend himself against those allegations. So that will take place at the local level, and then it will kind of escalate up to the level of the state folks who are certifying that officer can stay on the force or not.
And if you're tuning in, we are speaking with the state auditor, Suzanne Bump. She's our guest for this segment. As we roll into our final part of the conversation, I have to ask you in regards to the pandemic. I mean, we're all dealing with it in our own certain ways. How have you and your office been able to endure COVID-19 and still do business as usual?
Well, I have to say that we're really fortunate in that we already had a lot of staff who were used to working out of the office. Auditors, when they are doing field work, they are out of the office with their computers in somebody else's office, looking over documents and processes and the like. And so, we saw this coming. And a lot of others of us had laptops anyway, just as a matter of course. But we quickly had everybody outfitted with computers and set up our systems so that we could work from home. And naturally, there were a lot of logistics that still had to be carried out after the fact. But we were able to quickly put together the planning that was necessary. And the planning, not just with technology, but also the planning in how were we going to ensure that there wasn't a lot of downtime for staff. Because we did encounter some difficulties for a short time in getting information from other state agencies that weren't as flexible as we were in going virtual. And so there was a lot of information that we were requesting from agencies that we were auditing that the folks that we were talking to didn't have access to because it was back in the office on the mainframe computers or in files, and they were at their home in Abington. So it was how were we going to keep things flowing? But we were able to do it. We had our same level of audit output, and by all of our measures, we were able to keep pace with our work.
Did you find that it created additional work, especially when it came in the areas of COVID relief spending? Because I know that there were a lot of different initiatives that were put forth, whether to assist small businesses, whether it was PPP, whatever it may have been.
Right.
You had federal government CARES Act money coming in.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think that most people don't appreciate the scale of the federal support that has come to the state. $68 billion worth of assistance. Now, that didn't all come to the state government. In fact, most of it came in the form of the Payment Protection Program that you just referenced. That was $38 billion went to prop up local businesses in the state. Now, we won't be auditing that. And then there was $18 billion that went to supplement unemployment assistance, because if you recall, there were extra stipends and people were able to stay on longer because of the unique circumstances provided by the pandemic. That still leaves a very large chunk of money that has gone, some cases, directly to our colleges and universities, principally to give out in the form of student financial aid. But it also supported all kinds of operations in state government. If you just think about a group home that's supporting developmentally disabled folks, you know, a state program, they needed special support in order to continue to serve their clients. And, you know, and then you look at the Department of Public Health, which is having its hands, more than its hands full, with public health programming. So there are a lot of state agencies and programs within those agencies that have received millions and millions of dollars from the federal government. We have already begun trying to determine how it is that and who it is that we will be auditing on to see how well they have spent the money. We've already begun a process of looking at the riskiest agencies. You know, that would be agencies that had a lot of money and had to spend it in a short time. And maybe we have seen in our past audits that they didn't necessarily always do a great job in protecting resources and procuring supplies and services. So we are formulating our plan when we get a little further down the road in terms of the spending and the reporting on the spending, then we will begin our audits to ensure that the state and all of the people that they contracted with have done the right thing with that money. And we want to find flaws in the spending first here at the state level, because eventually the federal government's going to be looking. And if they find fault, then the state will have to pay money back. And we don't want to be in that situation. So actually, I'm working cooperatively with the governor's office on this and the state comptroller on this. I had recommended back in May that we take the approach that state government did during our last recession. Do you remember when President Obama first took office and the economy had crashed?
Yep.
And they had the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and that brought hundreds of millions of dollars into the state. We did a lot of shovel-ready infrastructure investment projects with that, and supported public education and the like. At the time, Governor Patrick set up a coordinated working group with the IG and the AG, the auditor, the comptroller, you know, to get an early jump on looking at how that money was spent. So I advised the governor to replicate that, put on the state's website, just as had been done under the Patrick administration, detailed information. So if somebody wanted to find out how the COVID money has been spent in this state, who are the contractors that wanted to, that, you know, that got the contracts for PPE or whatever it is, you can go to the state's website, mass.gov/COVID-19, and there's a full accounting of all of the allocations and who the money has gone to so far.
We have been speaking with the state auditor, Suzanne Bump. The Office of the State Auditor conducts
performance audits in state government programs, departments, agencies, authorities, contractors, and vendors. Interesting note here is that the OSA issues recommendations to improve accountability, efficiency, and transparency, and has identified $1.3 billion in unallowable and questionable, potentially fraudulent spending, right, saving opportunities for the Commonwealth. Interesting last sentence here is last year, auditees reported implementation of 92% of the auditor office's audit recommendation. I want to thank you so much for being my guest on this program.
It's been such a pleasure, Kevin. It's great to see you. Stay healthy. I look forward to seeing you again in person.
Sounds like a plan, and a quick shout out to Noah for doing a great job and helping us organize this conversation.
Thank you.
Daddy, Daddy, I used that tea kettle to melt the ice off your windshield. Now there's beautiful and pretty crisscrosses and sparkly spiderwebs all over the windshield.
What?
Can we do Mom's too? Can we?
Oh, windshield broken? My boys do a good job.
My dad did a great job. 1-888-64-TINIES. Just call.
That meeting's starting at 4. Can I get those projections?
Indeed knows unexpected growth can stretch your business thin.
Karen, do these numbers look right to you?
Like at Mia's research firm. To hit client deadlines, she needs to get started hiring right away.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. And the moment you sponsor a job on Indeed, you get a short list of quality candidates from our resume database. Visit Indeed.com/credit and get a $75 credit for your first sponsored job post. Terms and conditions apply.
As a dentist, I know what my patients are saying during times when they really can't speak.
Mm-hmm.
She says her gums are irritated.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything you can do? Absolutely. You can try New Crest Advanced Gum Restore.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, New Crest Advanced Gum Restore. It detoxifies below the gum line to restore your gums back to health in just 7 days.
Healthy mouth.
Exactly. Healthy gums, healthy mouth.
New Crest Advanced Gum Restore. Healthy, beautiful smiles for life.
Invest your time in listening to Cape Retirement Radio and learn a smarter approach to investing so you can protect your future. Cape Retirement Radio, featuring Chris Letond, Thursday nights at 6:15 and Sunday mornings at 10 on 95.9 WATD.
What is AA? Alcoholics Anonymous is an international fellowship of men and women who've had a drinking problem.
It is non-professional and self-supporting.
AA is multiracial, apolitical, and available almost everywhere.
There are no age or education requirements. Membership is open to anyone who wants to do something about their drinking problem.
Call 617-426-9444 or find online meetings at aa-intergroup.org.
In the year 2020, a powerful replica of the Vietnam Wall in Washington, D.C. will be permanently displayed at the Veterans Memorial Bicentennial Park in Fall River for veterans, families, and visitors from our local area, as well as all of Massachusetts and Rhode Island. The wall will honor the men and women who made the heroic and ultimate sacrifice in Vietnam. Help us make this very special memorial a reality. Please visit VietnamMemorialWall.org.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Time now for our final segment of the evening. And you always save the best for the last. Joining us, we're going to have a conversation about the city of Brockton. We do regular updates. Some great news in recent days in regards to returning to school. And we'll get an update in regards to some of the numbers. We start by introducing school superintendent Mike Thomas. I think this is his very first time on Monday Night Talk. So, Superintendent, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kevin. Thanks for having me, Mayor.
And getting top billing as always, as we call him fondly. He is the our co-host. Whenever he joins us, he is the Monday Night Talk co-host, unofficial co-host. Brockton Mayor, 50th Mayor of the City of Champions, Robert Sullivan, joins us. Mayor, welcome. Welcome back to the program.
You know, Kevin, it hurts me when you always say unofficial. I thought it was official. I'm a co-host. Come on.
No, but I want to thank you, Kevin, for having me on again. And I want to thank, of course, Superintendent Mike Thomas. And Mike and I have known each other since the 80s. We both went to Brockton High. And, you know, we have been working every single day, during COVID. And this is really going to be a really informational session tonight. So thanks for having us on.
I may have to get like a proclamation, you know, a radio station proclamation that makes you the official goers Monday Night Talk. I'll make that happen.
Okay.
All right. I say this honestly, it's fantastic to be able to have a regular dialogue like we do earlier on in the show with state reps and the state senators, to be able to speak to folks in the communities that we serve, and we serve so proudly, especially the city of Brockton and with your office, Mayor. So we definitely thank you. We should start out by at least kind of getting a little bit of an update. How are things going as far as the numbers? How are they trending when it comes to COVID-19 and any positive testing?
Yeah, I mean, so we're still in the thick of things. We're still in a red classification. We've lost over 390 residents to this deadly virus, almost 12,000 total cases now, and almost 2,500 positive active current cases. So, Dr. Rick Herman, MD, who is our medical consultant, he does a deep dive every day. He puts the dashboard on the city website. He's working with Mike and the school side, with the school committee, 7 members and 11 members of the city council. So again, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel, the positivity of a rollout is happening. It's not happening as quickly as we'd like, but that's everywhere in the Commonwealth and the nation in terms of quantity of vaccines, Kevin. But, we are working diligently collaborating with our local hospitals. Of course, we have 3 of them here. We have the VA, we have Good Samaritan, we have Brockton Hospital. So they're getting some vaccines that they're able to give to Brockton residents and people affiliated with their own respective medical facilities. And Neighborhood Health Center in Brockton on Legion Parkway is a game changer for us. They've been an unbelievable partner working. And I want to thank Mike on this, is his role as superintendent. First, they started working at Brockton High School outdoor to do the testing, stop the spread testing. And then it got cold, so we brought him over into a trailer over in the Shaw's Center parking lot, which is a Brockton asset, and now they're indoors. But they were just designated, believe it or not, by President Biden. They are getting a federal allotment of vaccines, and I want to thank Sue Joss, the CEO, and Dr. Maria Celli and all the team at Neighborhood Health Center, because they're getting shots in the arms and saving lives, not just of Brocktonians, but neighboring communities as well.
You know, it's interesting knowing that we're seeing the numbers trend down. Superintendent, you know, how long has it been in the planning stages to go from a full remote? Because Brockton is one of the few communities that said, No, let's not have a yo-yo effect with our students. Let's wait until we see things go in the right direction. How long ago was the conversation that when it's time, you'll do things in certain steps?
It's been going on since last May. So last May, I formed a reopening committee made up of about 80 different staff members from across all different subjects, administration, teachers, support staff, parents were involved, students. So we had to come up with a reopening plan for the Department of Education. We had to have 3 plans, a full remote plan, a hybrid plan, and then a full in-person plan. So we've been planning this since last May of 2020. And you had to be able to go between all 3 depending on where the metrics were. And obviously we opened in the school committee with the help of the mayor, the chair of the school committee, and Dr. Herman started meeting with us. I think Dr. Herman joined us, I think it was May, last summer sometime, June or so. So Dr. Herman continued to work with the school committee, give them biweekly updates on where the numbers were. And then we saw the numbers starting to increase as we were coming out of the summer. And we felt that it was the best interest of the safety of our students, their families, and our staff to stay fully remote. But we've had a plan to come back hybrid since last May.
Yeah, I mean, I Kevin, you know, as mayor, I also chair the school committee. And I want to applaud Superintendent Thomas and his team. because, you know, the seven school committee members, of course, there's seven wards here and 28 precincts in Brockton. So we have really seven great public servants on the school committee side. And Mark D'Agostino from Ward 3 is the vice chairman of the school committee. And, you know, we all have a shared vision. We want to make sure that the boys and girls students and the teacher staff can get back in a hybrid form. But it had to be a safe. We kept saying it has to be safe. So, you know, Dr. Herman doing a deep dive and working with the other health providers, and Dr. Linda Cahill, who is head of the school nursing program. She's been unbelievable as well. Dr. Eno Montes here from Board of Health. So one thing that I can tell you is that, we are trending in the right direction number wise. But with the leadership of superintendent and, you know, working with our partners, both public and private, the goal is to make sure that we have a safe environment for the kids. And I want to thank superintendent because just last week, last Tuesday, our special interest, special needs, the SPED kids were able to get back in the classroom in a hybrid form. And Mike, you and I toured that with Dr. Cliff Murray at Brockton High. Can you tell the listeners what your thoughts were? Because it was an awesome experience.
That was great. And we toured Brockton High School on last Tuesday just to see the kids back in the classroom with their teachers. It was just a great thing to see. It was thrilling, actually. And we were able to see not only the students in person, just the parents who have chose to keep their students remote due to health issues and concerns. They were zoomed into the class and following the lesson along with the teacher. Who was doing live streaming. That was at Brockton High. And yesterday I was at Huntington School and the same thing was going on there. I was at the Kennedy School this morning, the same thing there. Just to be able to get into schools, walk around and see students again, it's just been amazing. And I remember, and I looked at the date, it was March 11th, 2020, that I walked across to the mayor's office. And it was probably about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I said, I think we're going to have to close for a couple of days and do some deep cleaning because, people were starting to get really nervous as the virus was starting to spread. And we got reports that there were a few people in schools that had it and family members, and people were really starting to get nervous. I said, May, I think it's best we close. And he was 100% in agreement along with our school committee. I think we were one of the first districts who announced that we were closing. And we closed for that Thursday and Friday, March 12th and March 13th. And that weekend, I think it was Saturday afternoon, the governor shut us down, I think at that time for 2 weeks. And then, you know, what happened for the rest of last spring, and we were shut down for the year. So it was great to get back into. So it's been a long time since I've walked around the school with students inside.
You know, I would imagine that the students were overjoyed to be out of their homes and to be in the classrooms. I would be curious as to how your teachers and faculty felt to actually be face-to-face, somewhat one-on-one with these students. Did you have a chance to witness that emotion and that excitement with your staff?
Absolutely. So last Tuesday I was there and I saw videos. I was there when the students were arriving and the teachers were out with pom-poms and balloons and music was playing. Every school did something different to welcome. There were signs, welcome back. And again, the teachers were great. And the support staff out there welcoming staff back. I mean, students back and enthusiastic. People are nervous, but it has not shown their commitment to the students. They have not shown their anxiety and them being nervous. They're all in, and they've been just great welcoming students back.
And you are tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. And we are speaking with Brockton Mayor, co-host of Monday Night Talk, Robert Sullivan, as well as Superintendent of Schools, Mike Thomas. And we're talking about COVID, a COVID update, and the return to students in classrooms in the city of Brockton. You know, being the leader of the city, you know, the executive branch of the city, how does it feel for you, Mayor, knowing that, you know, when you started your term, it was just a few months later, we went into kind of like this, it's almost like this germ type winter, so to speak, where, you know, you had to close things down. And you stated earlier, like the light at the end of the tunnel Does it feel like that light is going to get brighter and brighter? We're going to see things return to normal for the City of Champions.
Well, I think, you know, the way of using the word normal is going to be different depending on the ebb and flow of this virus and the variants that are out there. But I will tell you this, that, you know, I took office January 6th of 2020. And as Mike said, you know, come March, we were already thinking about closing down schools, and we did do that. And, you know, my title is mayor, and it's an honor and privilege to be the mayor of the City of Brockton. But both Mike and I are dads of young children. And my own three kids, you know, two of them are at Brockton Public Schools. One goes to a parochial Catholic school, and they're 100% remote right now. And it's just not normal. You know, the way we grew up, you know, you go to school and you're with your friends and you go to recess and you go to gym and you go to lunch and you listen to the teachers and you do your homework and you do it again the next day. So, you know, one thing that what I can say is that the buy-in of collaboration on the Brockton Public Schools, working with Kim Gibson, who, again, is product of the Brockton Public Schools. She is the president of the BEA, the teachers union. It's been unbelievable. And everybody has a shared vision, right? We want to get kids back in the classroom, what's normal, and the teachers and staff as well, right? And we're getting there. But also, we just have to reiterate again that it's the parents, the guardians, the loved ones' choice. If you do not want your child to go back in a hybrid, we're not forcing you. We are ready, willing, and able to make any accommodations. And that's one thing Mike and his leadership as superintendent. Mike's a friend of mine, but he's an unbelievable leader. I would argue he is the best of the best superintendents in the Commonwealth. We're fortunate to have him. But one thing you got to listen to about Mike Thomas is he tells the truth. He doesn't sugarcoat things. And what he had said to the school committee is, listen, we're dealing with a virus. It hasn't happened in 100 years, a pandemic. So let's work together and figure out how we get to where we want to go. And, you know, tomorrow being Tuesday, it's another phase of hybrid in Brockton. And Superintendent, could you share who's coming in tomorrow and then what the progression is over time?
Absolutely. So tomorrow we'll welcome back our pre-K and kindergarten students at our elementary schools. Our sixth graders into our middle schools, and then our ninth graders into our high schools. And the reason we did that is this is the first time those students are going to be going into those buildings. As you know, first time for a new pre-K and K student in elementary. This is the fifth graders going into middle school. And then obviously middle school is going into ninth grade. That's a tough time for students, even in normal times, to go into new buildings and get used to them. So we felt it was important that they came back and had a week to themselves just to get used to arrival, dismissal, passing through the hallways, seeing the new building, seeing the new teachers, even though they've seen them in the remote world, and then mask breaks and going to the boys and girls rooms. And it's just the way we have to function now. So eating in the cafeteria and all the different things that come with being in school during COVID, that we have to follow the CDC guidelines. So they'll come back. They'll come back tomorrow, and then next Tuesday, the 9th, we'll welcome back our first graders through fifth graders at our elementaries, our seventh and eighth graders at our middle schools, and then we will welcome back our 10th graders at the high school, and then the following week we'll welcome back the 11th and 12th graders, and then we'll be back. All grades will be back in by the third week of March.
That's fantastic news. Knowing that you've been remote the whole time, and I'm asking you this, Superintendent, I'm asking you this, Mayor, where you haven't had individuals in those schools. What are they, 28 schools in the city? How many are there?
There's 25.
25, okay. I embellished a little bit. I apologize.
That's okay.
But, you know, coming what comes with adding these, you know, going phases and adding students and switching them over from remote to hybrid to being in person is going to incur a cost. Is the city, is the school department ready for that incurred cost to be able to do those regular cleanings on a regular basis, Mayor?
So first of all, your listeners are Plymouth County, and I want to thank the Plymouth County commissioners. I want to thank Chair Greg Hanley. I want to thank Plymouth County Treasurer Tom O'Brien and Sandra Wright and Jared Valenzuela, and the previous chair was Dan Pallotta. because the Federal CARES Act allowed Brockton and the Brockton Public Schools. We are not a wealthy community, right? We're a great community of diversity and hardworking people, but we're not wealthy. But because we were able to utilize the Federal CARES Act, we spent $7 million and every boy and girl has a laptop. We're a one-to-one school district. Never thought it would happen. You know, when Mike and I were there in the 80s, we were sharing books. So, you know, at the end of the day, our partners in the Plymouth County has been wonderful. We are entitled to $18 million, $7 million we've spent. But we spent a lot of money on PPE and disinfectant and these spray guns. And I want to thank Brockton Public Schools facilities and custodians, because when Mike and I last Tuesday were walking, Brockton High, which is one of the largest public high schools east of the Mississippi, was spotless. It was beautiful. It was shiny. And it was just, it was welcoming. And so my question to the superintendent is Mike, how do you envision, because sports, you know, football and some sports, how do you envision the rest of this academic school year in the Brockton Public Schools? How do you envision that?
Well, I think, again, Mayor, I want to also thank Plymouth County, and I want to thank you and Troy Clarkson and Aldo Petronio. I don't think there's a school system in the state that has done what we have done with the PPE. We bought over 2,000 air purifiers, every classroom, every gymnasium, every cafeteria, every classroom in the Brockton Public Schools has an air purifier. We had all our air exchange rates evaluated, everything we needed to do. PPE gave every student, every faculty member, Brockton Boxer masks, three of them each. We have thousands of paper masks that's back up. There they are. And we have, it just, you know, we installed over 3,000 hand sanitizer stations. We have face shields, we have gloves, anything you need for PPE, we have it. So, and again, thanks to Plymouth County and the mayor's office and our finance departments for really taking full advantage of that. So again, we're coming back at a 25% because our schools are so large. As you know, Brockton High School is 4,200 students. We have three elementary schools who are close to 1,000. We have one K to 8 school that is over 1,000. And then we have our middle schools all are at least 700 and above. So we have very large schools. We want to phase students back in, have them get used to it. And then hopefully as we move into mid to late April, we can bring students back at a 50%. And then we'll see, we'll go from there. I know that the state is looking to get 100% back in. I think after some, what I've been hearing from Commissioner Riley, that applies more to districts that have been, you know, really in the yellow for a long time and have not come back like the state feels they should. But I think for Brockton Public Schools, I think we're on par for the plan that we have. And I think we'll continue to see that. And, you know, by the grace of God, we might be back in full person, but I don't really know when that could be. During this school year, but we would want to be back at least 50% for all students, you know, before the end of the school year, no question about it.
And that's definitely good news that at least there's a plan moving forward. There's a vision to hopefully have all students back in full attendance. But are there challenges, Superintendent, as to if you're going to have all these students in, is where we're accustomed to having the social distance of 6 feet? You know, is it a matter of maybe you can narrow it down to 3 to 4 feet and still be able to have proper classroom sizes to be able to have? Is that something that's being discussed or bandied about in order to complete that final phase and have everybody in school?
Yeah, we've evaluated all our classrooms. With the current guidelines through the CDC, it was very difficult for us to come back 100% and maintain 3 feet. Again, the size of our schools are very large. Some of our schools are older buildings that don't have, you know, classrooms are built with bigger classrooms now. So it would be very difficult with the current CDC guidelines for us to come back in a full 100% model with our, you know, with the size of our schools right now. 50%, we could come back and keep at a 6 foot distancing. And thanks to the mayor, the school committee, we are committed, again, because of the metrics in Brockton, even though they're going down, we thought it was safe to bring students back and maintain the 6 feet. And if we do switch to a 50%, we're pretty positive we would also be able to remain with that 6 feet of social distancing. if we were coming back 100%, it would be very difficult to keep 3 feet. And that's why, you know, we have to continue to see where the metrics go, how many vaccines get rolled out. So that's, again, we have plans for that, but we need to see, you know, it's mostly to see where the vaccine, how fast the vaccine is going to get rolled out before we can consider any way we could bring 100% of the students back.
Yeah, you're just tuning in. We're speaking with the Brockton Mayor, Robert Sullivan, and the school superintendent, Brockton School Superintendent, Mike Thomas, and big news last week, being able to have welcome students back into the classrooms. And, you know, this is going to be happening in phases. Tomorrow is another phase that will happen. And then the next Tuesday, this is great that this is happening. Mayor, I have to ask you, and that is, you know, I'm sure that just because we're seeing a light at the end of the tunnel, that your conversations with Dr. Rick Herman aren't any lesser, because there is still a lot of unknowns. People are getting vaccinated, but myself, being someone who's been vaccinated, you know, I asked, this is, how long is this good for? There's still a lot of unknowns. They're still trying to figure out if there are other variants, is it going to be effective? Is it going to be effective with other offshoots of the virus?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that we have to do right now, because Brockton is such a diverse community, is we need to reach out to every ethnic community in Brockton. And, you know, we're doing that right now. I have a standing call, and I've done it for almost a year now, with pastors in our Haitian community and Cape Verdean community and Nigerian and Angolan community and Latin community, because, again, there is some apprehension because it's untested and unknown. Is some of the view. Now, I would say it has been tested, because there were 40,000 clinicians that took a placebo and 40,000 clinicians that took the real deal. So when I have the ability to roll up my sleeve, I'm in phase three, I'm in general public, I'll get that shot, because I know it saves lives. And, you know, right now, because Brockton has tragically been hampered forever, emotionally, physically, financially, because of COVID, we have to continue to really educate and inform of the value, so people will roll up that sleeve and get that shot. And, you know, one thing that, you know, I can say that both Mike and I share is we love Brockton. We love every aspect of Brockton, and, you know, the goodness of Brockton, of the people. And right now, we're people that are struggling right now because of COVID-19. But the benefits of hybrid education and a vaccine rollout, that's the promise and that's the hope. So, you know, I think, Kevin, that, you know, I'm not medically trained, but I rely on my medical consultant and all the doctors that I talk to. And, you know, we need to just continue to be diligent and vigilant. You can't be complacent. Social distance, wear the mask, wash your hands no less than 20. Everything that they tell us to do, we have to continue until we get to a number that is zero in Brockton. And the worst part of my job is every day at 4 o'clock, I get the death count and the sick count. So I want to get to a point where I get a call at 4 o'clock and it's zero. So, you know, this is great. This is information. And, you know, as the unofficial official co-host, I want to say a little known fact about our superintendent, our esteemed guest tonight, Mike Thomas. He had a heck of a jump shot when he played for Brockton High basketball. So my question to you is, Mr. Superintendent, if I gave you the ball right now and said shoot free throws, would you hit two?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. Just don't ask me to move. As long as I can stand right where I am and shoot.
What position were you? Where, I mean,
I was a guard.
You were a guard?
Yeah, off guard, not a point guard.
Oh, okay. So you like to distribute the ball, or you were a shooter?
Yeah, I like to shoot more than I like to pass.
He was a team player then, and he's still a team player. How's that?
We just got a couple of minutes left here in this great segment, and we should probably try to do it a little bit more often. And I would ask, is anything we haven't touched upon, Superintendent, that you want to take a moment to kind of talk about? Same with you, Mayor, after the superintendent has his moment. Anything you want to kind of just put out there or share?
Yeah, I just want to thank, again, our teachers and our staff and the support of the mayor's office and our school committee. When this pandemic hit last year and we had to switch to remote learning, this was not a district ready for it. As you know, Kevin, we have made severe budget cuts over the last 10 years. And one of the first thing always to get cut was technology, because you had the idea was you needed to protect with classroom teachers and staff. Even though we still had to, after cutting technology and programs, we had to cut staff as well. And then for us, again, we would, like the mayor said, we were not a one-to-one school district where every student had a computer. But we were able in a few months to secure a computer for every student, get a new learning platform, get teachers trained to go online and teach online, which has never been done before, for a district that really had was nowhere near ready for that. Our teachers were not trained over years because we just continued to cut. So the job that they have done with the support of the mayor's office, the school committee, again, the great work that Kim Gibson does as a union president, to get to where we are now, where we were recognized by the Department of Education for doing one of the districts doing the most live teaching throughout this year in the remote world, is simply amazing. I mean, if you told me to start an online school for 16,000 students and plan it, it would take 2 to 3 years to get that all up and running in the normal world. But so just the job that has been done by the staff here in the Brockton Public Schools with the support of the mayor and the school committee has been second to none.
Mayor, we have 1 minute left and it is yours.
Yeah, no, I just want to thank Superintendent Mike Thomas. I want to thank everybody at Brockton Public Schools, of course, the boys and girls students, but the staff, the dedicated professionals. We have a wonderful group of teachers and paras and everybody that makes it run. And I want to thank you, Kevin, because you always reach out to Brockton and you want to educate and inform. And I say this, what's good for Brockton is good for all the other communities in Plymouth County and vice versa. We're all in this together. You know, every community, every municipality has been hampered and damaged by COVID. But we're learning to try to figure out and how to pivot. So we're doing that well. And we'll continue to work together in a collaborative approach with our public and private partners to get where we need to go. And on behalf of everybody in the City of Champions, Kevin, we want to thank you for having both myself and the superintendent of the schools on this evening. It's always fun. We always have a laugh. But, you know, we talk about the serious information, but we, you know, we will come back anytime you want us to come back because it's that important.
He is the Brockton Mayor, Robert Sullivan, also a co-host of Monday Night Talk, as well as Superintendent of Schools. Mike Sullivan has been my guest for this particular segment. We thank you for tuning in. And folks, that's all the time that we have for this evening. Until next week at 6:15 p.m., you've been tuned in to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WAV.